Hey everybody, welcome back to The Damage Report. I am John Iadarola. Hey, it's Wednesday, but it's not JR Wednesday. Michael Shore.
Yep, sorry to disappoint, but
it's not much of a disappointment. We're gonna be okay.
All right,
but glad to have you back. It's been a while since we had you here.
It's great to be here. It's been a long time.
It's been a bit, and I know that Brett is going to be very excited because he's been trying to book you on the main show and he hasn't been able to recently. And apparently now you're back in town.
Yeah, I'm back in town.
So good news for him. Some good news for you guys, I guess. If you're not big fans of Donald Trump, you might get a little bit of schadenfreude out of the most recent reporting from the New York Times, which we'll be talking about in just a little bit. Turns out the reports of his business success in the 80s and early 90s might have been a little bit exaggerated, just a little bit. So we'll talk about that. But we've got lots more we're gonna get to. A little bit later on the show, some video from 15 years ago of Elizabeth Warren talking about housing, subprime mortgages, and all of that. Very interesting in light of, you know, obviously what happened after that. So we're gonna be talking about that and a little bit more about Elizabeth Warren in the 2020 Democratic primary. We've got horrible news for up to 1 million species across the face of the earth. We'll be talking about the implications of that. More on climate change with an awesome representative of Extinction Rebellion, an international climate change group. They're gonna be talking about some of their recent London protests and even more. Obviously lots to get to, why don't we jump right into it. The New York Times apparently got access to quite a bit of financial documentation from Donald Trump and was able to figure out some very interesting stuff about his financial goings on and success or lack thereof back in the 80s. So I wanna just hit on a couple of the important points. You should go read the full report. It is incredibly both well documented and also very detailed. But the numbers show that in 1985, Mr. Trump reported losses of $46.1 million from his core businesses, largely casinos, hotels, and retail space and apartment buildings. They continue to lose money every year, totaling $1.17 billion in losses for the decade, which is obviously a lot of money. But I know that Donald Trump is a guy that likes to be number one. And it turns out in this case he might have been, because in fact nearly year after year, Mr. Trump appears to have lost more money than nearly any other individual American taxpayer. The Times found when it compared his results with detailed information the IRS compiles on an annual sampling of high income earners. His core business losses in 1990 and 1991, more than $250 million each year, were more than double those of the nearest taxpayers in the IRS information from those years. And that was significant for him, not just because it's possibly record breaking, but also because he lost so much money that he was able to avoid paying income taxes for 8 of the 10 years. Which is significant because it means that not only did he apparently lose a lot of money on his businesses, but he saved a lot of money that he would have otherwise had to pay in taxes. Michael Shore, I guess, I mean, we're not really necessarily surprised, but it's still a big number.
Right, and there's a thing about people who are from New York who knew Donald Trump. Everybody from New York seems to think that they knew this already, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is something we knew, that he was a failed businessman. He was a wannabe success who really wasn't successful, had all these bankruptcies. And then he got a TV show. And that TV show transformed his public persona to the point where he's now president. But it's sort of one of these things that has kind of been an on the street story, not with this unbelievable detail that he was maybe the biggest loser in America during for that period. But it also, and you know, somebody said to me yesterday, well, what does it matter, right? You know, why do we care now? He's already president. That was in the, you know, 20, 30 years ago at this point. Why does that matter? Well, it matters because you had the Secretary of Treasury 2 days ago say that, no, we're not going to turn over his tax returns.
So the Why would those two things be related? I don't understand.
That's the thing, and that's really what I'm here to help you with, John.
Okay, I still don't get it, but keep trying.
And because of that, and because of this continuing to hide, what we already know about the taxes that he has already filed lead one to believe that perhaps there's a lot hiding in there, and there may be greater pressure now to release the most recent taxes.
There might be, and look, this is a big story today. We're going to talk about a couple different aspects of this. I'm continually surprised by how, no matter how big a story is, it's the inability of it to stick. Like, this is huge, obviously, but late last year there was reporting about tax evasion, basically, and the transfer of wealth from Fred Trump to his kids. And they showed that apparently they might have avoided paying over $500 million in taxes.
Yeah.
And does anybody even remember that? Like, like, how difficult would it be to track down a financial crime as big as that any politician right. in the last half century in America had committed.
And the fact that it's, you know, there is a party divide in that, right? I mean, Republicans can make those stories go away for some reason more quickly than Democrats and others can.
Yeah.
And when you look at, you know, what the kind of life these stories have, there's a little bit of moving on from what was in the past to what is right now. But everything that happened then informs what's going on right now. So you have to take that stuff into consideration about Trump. And the fact that nobody's leaving his reservation is the craziest.
Yeah. And if your theory is that Donald Trump, his father, and then he and the rest of his family spent decades gaming the system, possibly breaking the law to make as much money as possible and avoid paying as much taxes as possible, and then sometime during the run of Seinfeld, they stopped. That's an interesting theory, I guess, but I would like to look at the documentation, I guess.
And the lengths to which wealthy Americans go to avoid paying taxes, which are generally huge amounts of money for them, is extraordinary. And the fact that they're able to get away with it and do it legally is shocking, and illegally remains to be seen.
Yeah, and so obviously there are implications for the taxes, and there's a couple different ways that people are pursuing getting them. I just saw today that the New York State Senate is considering a bill that would allow them to see his state taxes at the very least. And people are taking this seriously. AOC was tweeting about this morning. That's all important. The other part is why he is the president today. It's a complicated story. There's multiple elements. I think, you know, good old fashioned American racism is a big part of it, and he certainly appeals to that more than perhaps any other Republican politician. But the aura of success that he's crafted for himself is a big part of it. And this just shreds all of that. And I want to show you how he knowingly was lying to all of the people, everyone, but also many of the people who'd end up supporting him. So he said to Newsweek in 1987, "There is no one my age who has accomplished more," adding that the ultimate scoreboard was, quote, "the unfortunate obvious one, money." Last year's Times investigation found that he had received at least $413 million in our dollars from his father at that point. So at the same time, he was bragging to Newsweek that I hate that it's about the money, but when you go by the money, I've accomplished more than anyone because I've been paid hundreds of thousands of dollars a year since I was three, they revealed, and eventually millions of dollars. He's a millionaire by age eight. That must have been some lemonade stand. But he's the most accomplished. Now we know more. That was last year's report. Now let's take a look at what he was saying and what was actually happening in the 80s. You bring up this chart created by the New York Times. So you can see there, those are his losses per year. So he had a good year in 1985, where he only lost $51 million. But you can see the huge losses year after year after year going into the 90s. In 1987, he says, "I don't do it for the money. I've got enough, much more than I'll ever need," as he was losing $4.5 million. The next year, he said, "If the world goes to hell in a handbasket, I won't lose a dollar," perhaps because he'd already lost $46 million and didn't have much left to lose. In 1990, he said, "It's been good financially," proving that drugs in the early 90s must have been very effective because he lost $400 million that year. So this is all of what he's saying as he is failing in business after business after business, but successfully branding himself as a success.
Right.
And that is why people voted for him. Not because he was a good businessman. They don't know, and apparently we're finding out today, as we'll get into, they don't care. But they thought it. They were convinced that it was true. And of course, in more recent years, NBC, I guess, did more to spread that myth. One of the most consequential myths in American political recent history than anyone else.
Not to mention, he was losing money at a time where everyone who had money was making money hand over fist, right?
He lost it in casinos.
He lost it in casinos, which that's true. I mean, how do you lose money in a casino?
I
always lose money in casinos.
I don't own any.
But so you also understand why he hates the Clintons, right? Because during the Clinton administration, he lost $1 billion, right?
You know, that's some PTSD.
Right, exactly. But it is though. He has fooled a lot of people, right? Mm-hmm. He did it through all of 2015 and 2016. He's continuing to try and do it, and now that they're trying to figure out what's behind the Wizard of Oz there, they're going to be, you know, trying to defend that even more because he knows what's back there, and some of the people that are protecting him do as well.
Yeah. And he's also along the way possibly going to make the situation worse for himself, so I want to turn to another aspect. Imagine if you read a news report and it said, John Iarola claims that he was really cool when he was younger, but it turns out that he was LARPing every weekend. And then I tweeted, this is fake news. I couldn't have been LARPing because I was out every night killing people. That seems ridiculous, but that's effectively what Donald Trump is doing in response to the New York Times reporting about his business failures in the 80s.
Is the camera on me? Can I Google LARPing?
You might want to look it up.
Okay,
it's embarrassing.
Right, okay.
So basically, we found out that he lost well over $1 billion. And his response is to say, no, I didn't lose that in business. He says, real estate developers in the 80s and 90s, more than 30 years ago, were entitled to massive write-offs and depreciation, which would, if one was actively building, show losses and tax losses in almost all cases. Much was non-monetary, you know, except for the $1 billion. Sometimes considered tax shelter, you would get it by building or even buying. You always wanted to show losses for tax purposes. Almost all real estate developers did, and often renegotiate with banks. It was sport. Additionally, the very old information put out is a highly inaccurate fake news hit job. Well, I would say, which is it? Is it highly inaccurate or is it accurate? And now you're explaining why it happened. And why is your explanation effectively to, I'm not an economist, not a CPA or whatever. It sounds like he's saying, I'm not a failure, I committed tax fraud for years.
Right. And that is essentially what he's saying. I was successful at doing what I was doing to make it look like I was a failure, but I wasn't because I was successful doing it. I mean, that's his mumbo jumbo there. You know?
Yeah, I don't know what's the legitimate. He said it was sport. You pretend to have losses for tax purposes.
Right.
Again, if that's not tax fraud.
So now you're going to jail.
Yeah, I mean, in this particular case, I guess the crimes are too old.
Right.
It's one of the cool things about being an extremely wealthy person.
What's the statute on
tax fraud?
Yeah.
I have read references that if these were occurring in the 80s, that it's too old.
Right.
Now, if, and this is crazy, but bear with me.
Yeah.
If he was still doing this, and if his tax returns were to show that presumably would still be something that could be pursued.
Right. And but now is there a legal trigger that Congress has? Presumption of, because he's already admitted to tax fraud essentially with what he just said. Can Congress now go out and say, hey, we have a legitimate reason to investigate this?
I would
not
hope
just
so.
Congress, but the other bureaus of investigation, the SEC, all of that, to look at what his tax, the IRS especially, to look at whether or not there's fraud now.
I would hope so. I mean, I know back when Cohen was testifying and he revealed some of these little tricks, and he didn't give the specifics here. AOC asked some great follow-up questions, getting into how he was able to game both taxes, but also insurance as well. We have great documented evidence that he was lying to commit insurance fraud too. I think that's all the precedent you need to push forward.
It's probable cause, right? I mean,
exactly.
This is probable cause. So now there should be another level of investigating and getting access to those tax returns.
Let's turn to one more angle on this. New York Times reporting showing that Donald Trump was a massive fraud and liar about his business success that actually was a loss of well over $1 billion. You would think that that might cause some people who support him, in their words, because he was a great businessman, to second guess a little bit of that. I don't have a lot of optimism though, because I paid attention over the last 24 hours to Fox News, and they seem to be doing okay with this reporting. Take a look at Fox and Friends finding out that he is perhaps the biggest business loser over the past few decades in America.
So for you or I, maybe buying a summer home is a big move, or maybe even a trailer. But for Donald Trump, he says, I got some money, but I want to really expand my empire. I want to take chances. That's what he's done through his entire life as a personality, as a host, as a businessman.
Well, I think that's
guess what? Not all of us win on everything we buy.
I think that's how the voter feels.
Absolutely.
I feel like they realize he's a billionaire. If anything, you read this and you're like, wow, it's pretty impressive all the things that he's done in his life. It's beyond what most of us could ever achieve.
I don't know that there's any suggestion that he broke the law.
Yeah.
I think the suggestion is simply that he used the tax laws to his benefit.
As if you buy something and it doesn't pan out right away or ever, you're a loser. No, you take shots. You have an opportunity to do things. That's the way he lived. The reason why we all knew Donald Trump's name is for 30 years, that's what he did.
No, that's not why we know his name. We know his name because he was able to hide all of the actual facts of what was going on in his businesses and craft an entirely manufactured persona as a business success.
The only person, Steve Doocy, who is suggesting that he broke the law is Donald Trump.
Or
he's
today.
Today. He's the most prominent person to suggest that that's what he did. It was sport, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's basically saying that tax fraud is sport.
Yeah. And Ainsley Earhart, when she's like, you know, it's just, it's amazing the things he's been able to accomplish.
Right.
Like, okay, I guess when you like losing $50 million
fooling
year
America.
After year. Yeah, that's amazing, I guess. Like Johnny Knoxville hit himself in the balls a lot. I guess that's amazing.
Yeah.
I don't want that guy leading us necessarily. But they were able to push past it. It's like, you're not going to be a winner in everything. Okay, sure. But the issue is, we only know a little bit actual documented truth about Donald Trump. We know that all of the money he got initially was given to him. He was just handed hundreds of millions of dollars. And then the only actual numbers we have for what he did with that money was failure after failure after failure. Generalized financial failure in the 80s, leading to over $1 billion in losses and a long string of bankruptcies and closures of any number of different businesses. They were talking in that segment, we can't show you the whole thing, about, oh, it's just so amazing that he has this big plane and he wanted to buy these big planes. Yeah, and he also wanted to run an airline. And it failed, as all of those businesses failed. He was great at branding, that's true. But to continue to worship this guy, whose initial start was that he was handed cash, that he then squandered, could have made far, far more money if he'd simply invested it in CDs over that time. Their willingness to just go along with this is one of the frustrating things about political psychology, but psychology more generally. That when we find out information that says that what we previously believed was wrong, we tend to double down on that inaccurate belief. And you're seeing it in real time, their willingness to continue to look up to the leader of their cult because the alternative, actually taking a hard look at what Donald Trump is, the biggest con man in American history, is just incomprehensible for them.
Yeah, I mean, there's something tribal about it, and Cenk Uygur was right when he said we all kind of got annoyed at it after a while. Loser Donald, he actually literally was the biggest loser, or as Rick Tyler of NBC said, the bigliest loser. Mm-hmm.
I got annoyed with that too, just because I hate doing the same segment over and over. It's different information,
right.
but the people who were like pissed at us for doing that, like first of all, he's a disaster. We knew he was going to be. Turns out we were 100% right about that. Trying to attack him where he is supposedly the strongest was a good strategy. The idea that we should have spent that time punching Hillary Clinton in the face, she lost.
Right.
Like, she didn't need our help to lose that election. But we tried to stop this person who would go on to give trillions of dollars to the wealthy, separate families, all of that. Anyway, we do have to take a short break. We come back, the 2020 campaign, Facebook ads. Do they need to be grounded in reality? We'll find out after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
In this 2020 election, the first primaries and caucuses are like 7 years from now. But regardless, we're already getting tons of campaign advertising on places like Facebook. And if you have not already banned every mention of Donald Trump from your Facebook, you might have come across ads like this. Take a look at one that recently went out saying, Democrats have finally admitted what they truly want, a repeal of the Second Amendment. Which is interesting, not just because it's incendiary, but because I don't know what Democrats that's referring to. And yet that is an ad on a platform that says it has standards in terms of accuracy in advertisement. And those sorts of ads are being boosted by well over $100,000 a week in spending. And joining us now to break down the consequences of this and the fight to have a little bit more accuracy in political ads on Facebook, Jed Legum, creator of the newsletter Popular Information. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you on. And I know that you have been sounding, like beating the war drums on this over Facebook for some time. So tell us about your battle to get Facebook to be clear about what their expectations for advertisements are.
Yeah, well, this ad database is a new thing for 2020. We now, as opposed to the previous election, where if you put up an ad on Facebook, no one knew if you put up an ad or not. Now there's a database, a library that you can go and check. And basically what I've been doing is looking through on a daily basis and seeing which ads comply with Facebook's own rules. Facebook says you can't have advertising that's misleading. You can't have advertising that targets people in certain ways. And I've been sort of just checking what the Trump campaign has been doing, what some of the other campaigns and political entities have been doing, and comparing them against the Facebook rules.
I mean, look, considering all my frustrations I've had with Facebook when it comes to politics over the past few years, I like that they have this standard. But it seems like they're not really applying it. And honestly, when I think about the political ads that I've seen, something that's not inaccurate and doesn't target people, I don't know how many ads are actually going to get past those filters. And indeed, it looks like many are getting past. They're not being filtered out. And so you've been trying to get them to either stop these ads or get them to be more accurate. What has that been like? Has there been success?
Yeah, I mean, one of the primary issues is they have no, what they've admitted to me in the course of this reporting is that they don't really have any humans looking at the ads before they go up. They do run them through an algorithm, but obviously that algorithm isn't working very well. And so what I've been doing is after they've been posted, checking them against the rules and going to Facebook and say, hey, how does this comply with your own rules? And in many circumstances, Facebook has said, actually, now that we've looked at these ads and checked, they don't. And we've taken them down and told the Trump campaign that they have to change them if they want to get them back up. And so that's been going on, but it's a little bit of a uphill battle just because there's hundreds and hundreds of new ads per day. So it stretches my own ability, being an independent journalist, to check each one of them. Clearly, there needs to be more resources other than just me applied to this problem.
Judd, hey, it's Michael Shore. A question for you. Is there any kind of comment? I'm sure you've dug for it. Has Brad Parscale or anyone from the Trump campaign talked to you about what they're doing or answered questions that I'm guessing you've submitted to them?
I've heard from Facebook. I have not heard from the Trump campaign itself. I have observed that the Trump campaign has changed their strategy a bit since there's been more scrutiny to their ads. For instance, it's now no longer putting up ads like that Second Amendment ad that you showed at the beginning of the segment. And most of their advertising on Facebook now, at least the ones that's being done directly through the campaign, is much more innocuous, like sign Trump's birthday card, donate so you can be entered for a drawing to win a dinner with Trump. And so they've backed off some of the more incendiary stuff. But no, I haven't heard from them. Then they haven't had any comment on their advertising strategy. I do know that it's a big part of their 2020 strategy.
Yeah, I wanted a little bit more information on that because I saw in your write-ups about this issue, the back and forth we've had with Facebook, that the amount that's being spent is actually pretty significant, especially considering that he isn't really facing anything that I would consider to be a serious primary challenge yet, and the election is a long way off. Does it seem like Facebook is going to be one of the main areas that they're pushing?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at it on a weekly basis, they're already running $200,000 or more per week through Facebook, another $50,000 to $100,000 through Google. So that's $200,000 to $300,000 a week. Here we are out in May of 2019. So you have to imagine that's only going to ramp up as you get closer to November 2020. And so we're talking about millions of dollars per month that are being spent on these type of ads. And we've seen that last time in 2016, Trump was happy to be greatly outspent on traditional airwaves, but seize the digital advantage. So this is really at the center of what they're doing communications-wise, which is why I think it deserves a lot more attention than it's getting. One of the things that surprised me as I started to look into this is that how little scrutiny there is to these ads. Almost every time I notice a new ad, I haven't seen it mentioned anywhere else until, you know, I publish something about it. So it's something that's, I think, understudied relative to the weight that it's being given by the Trump campaign and their communications efforts.
I agree, and that's why we appreciate you doing this reporting. For people who might not be familiar with your independent newsletter, can you tell people about Popular Information, where they can see it?
Yeah. I've been following this pretty much every day, definitely on a weekly basis. In my newsletter, Popular Information, you can get it and sign up for free on popular.info. And it's basically a freemium model, which means you can sign up for free. You get it once a week. If you like it, if you love it, I suppose, and you want to get more, you can pay $6 a month and get it 4 times a week.
Well, thank you again, both the story, and we're going to be watching your reporting going forward on their social media strategy. Judd, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, Elizabeth Warren with a pretty timely prediction before the housing crisis, but 15 years ago, seems relevant today considering the primary we're in. We'll be talking about that after this. Last night I came across an awesome Twitter thread by Twitter user The Love Below, where they were sending out old videos of Elizabeth Warren, an interview from 2004, getting into effectively everything you needed to know at that time to avoid the housing crisis we would end up having not long after. Take a look at a little excerpt.
Think about what happens when you load up more debt on your house. Just you are rolling the dice at the table in Las Vegas. And here's how you're rolling it. You're rolling it that your income's going to continue to go up, that nothing serious is going to go wrong in your family that's going to make it hard to make those payments. Someone's going to get sick, you're going to lose a job, you're going to be without health insurance, someone's going to get divorced. None of those things are going to happen to you. And here comes the third one, the one you hit on. Home values are going to continue to rise. Does anyone have any memory? We know that home values fell just 20 years ago. They eventually recovered, right? But there are periods when they go down. Let's talk about Ronald Reagan's presidency. That's been in the news recently. Do you remember what was happening to home values in the early 80s? When interest rates go up, home values go down, and then here comes the real hooker. And when mortgage foreclosures start in earnest, it doesn't just affect the person who's been foreclosed against, it affects everybody up and down the block. When banks take homes away in foreclosure, housing prices for the entire neighborhood drop.
Okay, and that is just a small bit. It was obviously a long interview, and the interviewer, it's difficult to know now looking back to what extent he was sort of playing devil's advocate, but he was echoing a lot of the popular wisdom about, like, hey, it's going to be fine.
No, I mean, he was. I mean, that's David Brancaccio, who believes in just about everything that Elizabeth Warren is preaching. And that show was Bill Moyer's show that Brancaccio then took over. And
I can always count on you to know these people.
Yeah, well, and he was an NPR guy, David Brancaccio. And it took him a while to get good on TV, but that show was great. And the questions he would ask were almost feeding her the opportunity to answer in that way. That's what put Elizabeth Warren and her ideas on the map in the first place with the Consumer Financial Protection Board.
Yeah, and there's much more. Go to twitter.com/thelovebelow, the O is a zero, and you can see more of those. There's a bunch of them. And I just think about like what she was trying to accomplish in the years leading up to the crash. And obviously the crash wasn't just about housing, but that was a very significant part of it. And then look at like our current leadership, what they were doing. Donald Trump was opening up like, you know, companies like directly that would be destroyed by that a year before and talking it up. And, you know, obviously all of a lot of the financial pundits were, you know, like just encouraging people to go all in and everything. And like she knew, and nobody cares. It doesn't matter at all. Who cares? And that, I mean, one of the reasons I'm showing this is because writ large across the entirety of her identity and her campaign is kind of the thing. It's like, oh yeah, she's super smart and wonky. That's like a bad thing. That's what's said, that's bad about her. That she knew ahead of time that she was on the ball. Obviously, you know, later on she would be involved in the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Really important in those areas as well. But how little progress she's made on a platform of actually understanding the real financial challenges that individuals and the country face, having an actual plan to deal with them, it's like she's moved up a couple points.
Right, now, that's true. But and it's a good segue to when we're going to be talking about climate, et cetera, in just a little bit, because it's one of the issues that makes politics really difficult for the politicians is issues like climate change, like what Elizabeth Warren was saying way back then, which are, you don't feel them today. She's saying, she was talking about eventualities, divorce, death, illness, that sort of thing, foreclosure. You don't prepare for those things until you hit them when they happen. Mm-hmm. That's what makes them difficult campaign issues, and that's what makes her campaign and her candidacy a challenge for her, is to talk about things that what could happen. Here's why we need this. This is the plan, rather than right now, et cetera, et cetera, on those issues. She's doing it more. She's getting a little more traction. There are 21, 22 people running right now. Mm-hmm. It's sort of difficult.
And it's going to be a long race and everything. It's just like when I think about, God, if only we as a species were a little bit better at looking more than 5 minutes into the future.
Yeah.
That like Donald Trump won telling people literally at the convention, I alone can solve our problems. I alone can protect you. And what has he done? He, you know, dismantles the entire federal bureaucracy that would look into white supremacist and other extremist far right violence. You know, we're having a lot more of that, obviously. Wastes a ton of money on a wall that doesn't do anything to protect us. Tries to take away your health insurance, making it much more likely. And that, far more than anything related to terrorism, is going to lead to you possibly getting sick or dying. Meanwhile, she's actually looking ahead to the real risks, financial and otherwise.
Right. Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. Donald Trump's saying they're at our borders. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump is saying China's trying to kill us. We have to get into a trade war. These things are immediate emergencies, and only I can stop the emergency. That plays on the campaign trail as it did then. Talking about eventualities. I mean, we heard it from Al Gore on climate change too. It's very difficult to say, hey, in 40 years this is going to happen. You see it on social media right now. I mean, on Social Security right now, when people say, oh, the Social Security Trust Fund, oh, in 3032, it's, or 3026 or 3035, it's going to expire. Well, that's not today, right? Yeah. And that's what makes it difficult to translate when you're running for office. It shouldn't, and people are making strides with it, but it's a real frustration.
Yeah, and I understand that like these old videos, nobody cares. It's not going to get any views, but buckle up. I like them. I want to know who these people were, you know, 2 years ago, 10 years ago, 30 years ago. And to the extent that we can find that stuff, it was harder before YouTube. Thankfully, we, in this case, have been able to with Elizabeth Warren. So I'm going to continue.
Tax returns we can't get. This
no,
we
that's
can
tough.
Get.
Yeah. Tweets maybe.
Right.
Anyway, we're going to take a short break. We come back more on climate change after this. While climate change is proceeding at a frightening pace, thankfully, both here in the US and internationally, protest movements to get governments to do something about it are also heating up. And joining us now to break down one of the major parts of that international effort is Jamie Kelsey-Fry of Extinction Rebellion. Jamie, welcome to the Damage Report.
Hi, fantastic to be on your show. Thanks for getting us on.
I'm very glad that you came on. We've obviously been watching here from America what your group has been up to. For those who might not have seen the London protests, tell us about how those got started and what the objective was.
Wow, okay. If you didn't see it, I recommend you look at the films about it, because it's something quite extraordinary. If any of you have ever been to London, we took five of the main sites. We occupied five main sites for 10 days. So the famous shopping center, Oxford Street, in Oxford Circus, we had a large pink boat that we kept there. People were camping all around it. All the roads were blocked. That was there for 10 days, where we were holding assemblies, teach outs, and raising awareness about the absolute emergency of climate breakdown. That's just Oxford Circus. We also did something similar in Marble Arch, where there was a huge camp, and we shut down Marble Arch, occupied it for 10 days. Piccadilly Circus in the center of London, also occupied. That was mainly the Extinction Rebellion youth. And Waterloo Bridge, one of the famous London bridges, we turned into a garden for 10 days, where people lived and camped on that bridge. And Parliament Square, famously, we also occupied Parliament Square and shut that down. This was for 10 days. It's quite unprecedented to have such an extended amount of direct action and occupations. Over that period of time, we had nearly 1,100 arrests. The famous Gold Command police officer in charge, Cressida Dick, she was saying that in her 35 years of police experience, she's never seen anything like it at all. So it was an amazing action that happened, and it's struck a chord with the general public. This is no longer something to do with lefties or, you know, small groups of the population who are concerned about the climate change. It's everybody. And very tightly tied into this is Greta Thunberg, the 16-year-old from Sweden, who came over on October the 31st to declare the Extinction Rebellion with us, and she came back and returned to the camps during the occupations. So it's very tied in with the brilliant youth-led movement around the world, and your Sunrise movement in the States also is very much tied in with what's happening.
And those are basically the three crutches keeping me going day by day that you just mentioned right there. And so thank you for that, because I'm scared out of my mind. One of the goals, obviously, of the movement was to get access to representatives of the government and to try to push them in the right direction. So tell me about that.
Look, this is quite extraordinary. John. Yeah, this is quite extraordinary. That the fact is, in 10 days, we were able to force meetings. Well, win, should I say. We won meetings with the leading minister in the incumbent government, in the Conservative government, Michael Gove. We had a private meeting with him and some of his ministers about the environment. But we also had a meeting with the leader of the opposition, Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell. Jeremy Corbyn came in for some of that meeting. And also another meeting with the mayor of London. Just in 10 days, things like that don't usually happen with your normal activist group. But this is just, this is not a normal activist group. This is actually, in my opinion, it's not necessarily something you may call particularly political, not in the usual sense of the word. This is about humanity. And as you're talking about, you know, one of the things that's keeping you from, you know, keeping you sane is these crutches of these movements. It's real. It's an absolute emergency. If we don't treat it in the same way that we're treating a major war threat from another country, then we're looking at the most disastrous period in human history.
Jamie, it's the old guy talking to you now. part of the problem that people have with movements who are in your seat right now is sustaining them, is making them endure. What's the plan for that? Because this is not a sprint, as they say. This is quite clearly a marathon.
Yeah, well said. We declared rebellion on October 31st, and then we said we'll be back and we'll close five bridges on November the 17th, which we did successfully, and that hadn't happened for a very long time. And then you rest after some time like that, you recoup and you learn. It's a very iterative movement. We are operating in ways that I haven't seen any activist groups operate before, and we are learning every time from what happens, and we are being contacted by groups around the world all the time. We're in 43 countries. So I guess the answer to that question is there's a rest for sure, because it's exhausting to do that. But then also 30,000 people just in the UK alone signed on over those 10 days. So it's also a time of bringing more people on board and working out where their skills will be placed. We're also spreading out to district groups around the country. And also, as I've mentioned already, we're in 43 countries around the world as well. So it's now a period of recuperating, regenerating. We've got what we call a regenerative culture. What that recognizes, and I think this is one of the things that's very salient about this movement, we recognize the fact that this is exhausting. We recognize the fact that people get what we call burnout. And so we have at the center of what we do a regenerative culture. That means that we will rest and look after each other and continually pay attention to everybody being well enough psychologically, physically, in every way, so that they can continue with this. Because as you say, this is a long, long game.
That is fascinating. And after this show, I'm going to have to think about how to apply that to my own life and how TYT functions, actually, because that sounds useful. We don't have time, unfortunately, much more time. Hopefully, we can talk more going forward. But for people, you know, around the world who might be watching this that want to get involved with Extinction Rebellion, what can they do?
Look, just go to rebellion.earth. That's it. It's a really good website. And like I say, there's groups growing every day around the world and in the global south. Before we go, there's one thing that you said, you're dead right. Politicians cannot deal with issues like this. So you need to look at the way that we're using sortition and citizens' assemblies. Our only chance is for the people to unite and decide on how we make these changes. The existing system, as your great show continually shows, neoliberalism is a disaster. It's a disaster form of capitalism. And the only way out of this is for us to actually go around the system. And that will be done by us, human beings, together making this great change happen.
Thank you, Jamie, so much for coming on the show. It is great to hear someone talk about both this breakdown and also about addressing it with the passion and intensity that it requires. So thank you again.
Thank you. Bye.
We're going to take a short break. We come back up to 1 million or more species under threat of extinction thanks to human involvement. We'll be talking about that after this. Always sad when we have to close on bad news, but we're going to do it today. New report comes out that shows, lays bare, like really stark portrayal of the effect that humanity has had on animal species around the world in a number of different ways. And I just want to let you know how bad it is. This report that was put out by the UN's Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity, which you probably, you know, you have it bookmarked. But anyway, the report found that 25% of all mammals, more than 40% of amphibian species, nearly 33% of sharks, and 25% of plant groups are threatened with extinction. Based on these proportions, which by the way are the result of many, many researchers over a long period of time, all combining efforts, found that approximately 1 million animal and plant species could die out, many within decades. And look, all of this is tied together, the animals you like, the animals you don't like. I personally am scared of sharks, and so it might be easy for a person to look at that and say, oh, a third of sharks might go, which right. is consequential. 25% of plants, that's serious. That seems like a big one. And thankfully, it generated a little blip in the news that 1 million species might go. To put it in perspective, by the way, since the 16th century, humans have driven at least 680 vertebrate species to extinction, including the Pinta Island tortoise. The last known animal of this subspecies, a giant tortoise nicknamed Lonesome George, died at the Galapagos National Park in Ecuador in 2012. A subspecies of the Javan rhino went extinct in 2011, and the Western black rhino and Northern white rhino are extinct in the wild. Those things were news when they happened, and rightfully so. That's like three. We're talking about 1 million in the next few decades, potentially.
Yeah, there's not much you can say about it, except it's a, you know, it's completely tragic. And I think that the man-made impact on this is what needs to be underscored, mm-hmm. because some people are saying, well, that's just sort of over the millions of years of existence of animals and whatnot. They've all, I mean, dinosaurs died out and then new species came to rise. But this has been accelerated, and I think it's important to point out what scientists said, this has been accelerated to incalculable degrees by man. And
yeah.
So that also means it can be decelerated by man.
Theoretically, yes. This is effectively saying that over a short period of time, humanity's existence is like an asteroid hitting the Earth, effectively. Yeah. And it's caused by a number of different things. So you have humanity moving into areas and pushing animal species out. Toxins, pollutants, and things like that putting pressure on various parts of the Earth. Obviously, climate change is a significant part of it, especially for those amphibian species and fish species, things like that. The oceans are heating thanks to our efforts. And there's, you know, deliberate targeting of particular species. We've driven them to extinction purposefully. And that is going on with a number of these right now. Bear that in mind when you see a big game hunter shoot down one of, like 1% of all of a particular species. But this is a disaster. And I get, like you said, there's not much else to say, I suppose. And I guess that's part of the reason that you're not going to have a 16-person panel on CNN about this necessarily. But I don't know. I feel like we got to find a way to talk about it because this is pretty significant.
16 one-person panels would be great.
Exactly. Know? Yeah. Yeah. Don't bring on Jeffrey Lord. Bring on one of the people from the UN's Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services panel, I guess. And or what? Like, if you have, just bring on Bill Nye or Neil deGrasse Tyson and have them talk about it. They're exciting and charismatic. But this is super significant. And like the news that we talk about, I get caught up in it. Very exciting and important political news every day. None of it, basically everything that I've talked about on the show this year in total doesn't compare. It's not like a candle. You know what I'm saying, the analogy. Compared to the significance of this.
I had no idea what you were saying.
I don't know. We'll get to it at some point. It's important. Read up on the report. There's a 40-page summary. Obviously, the raw data is going to be very difficult, but the 40-page summary is totally digestible, incredibly significant, and keep the conversation going. Michael, as always, thank you for joining us.
It's great. I'm sorry to disappoint on JR Wednesday, but
that's okay. He's at the dentist. He'll be back.
With better teeth. Yeah.
Perhaps. And it'll be great to have you on, hopefully, on the main show soon as well. Thank you to everybody who's watching. If you haven't already, please rate and review the podcast if you're consuming it in that form on iTunes. It helps out immeasurably. And we'll see you tomorrow with a lot more news.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.